The truth is, we haven't really spoken yet about the laws of Muktzah. All that we've spoken about thus far has been introductory shiurim to the laws of Shabbos in general. So now let's get right into the laws of Muktzah itself. And the first question we need to ask ourselves is, when did the laws of Muktzah actually come about? When were they instituted? Is it something that is a biblical prohibition? Is it something that is only rabbinic? And that makes a major difference, as we will see. So we have a very conflicting approach to this. The Gemara tells us in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Kuf Chav Gimel, in the days of Nehemiah is the one who instituted this idea of Muktzah. Now, when did Nehemiah live? So we're told that Nehemiah was in the Tkufas Bayis Sheni. He lived in the times of the second Beis HaMikdash. He was one of the members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. So Nehemiah, it seems, was the one who instituted the idea of Muktzah. Where did he come up with this idea of Muktzah? Why did he institute the laws of Muktzah? So the Gemara says, because Nehemiah saw that the Jewish community as a whole was lax in its observance of Shabbos, and therefore he said, we have to do something to encourage people to be more careful about how they keep Shabbos. And therefore he said, what we're going to do is institute this new idea of Muktzah, and this way that will lead to a heightened sensitivity of the laws of Shabbos in general. Why did he choose Muktzah itself as opposed to anything else? Where do you dream up such an idea? So that we'll talk about next week. But Nehemiah basically realized something needed to be done in order to encourage the stricter and more careful observance of Shabbos, and this is the idea that he came up with. That's what the Gemara tells us. Now, the problem with that Gemara is the following. What we mentioned is that Nehemiah lives in the times of the Bayis Sheni. That's a very critical point of information. Because the Gemara, 100 pages earlier, the Gemara Masechet Shabbos, seems to have a contradictory opinion. The Gemara there in Masechet Shabbos tells us a very interesting anecdote about David HaMelech. So David HaMelech asked the question that I would assume many of us would want to know. Hodieni Hashem Kitzi. David HaMelech says, I have a lot that I want to accomplish in life. I have a lot that I'm trying to do. I have a lot that I wish I can do. And he says, I would love to know, God, when is my time going to come? How much longer do I have to do all the things that I want to do? If there's something that I cannot accomplish, I may as well not get involved in it. So David HaMelech asked the Ribbono Shel Olam, can you tell me when my end is going to come? This way I can plan accordingly. A question many of us would like to know. And David HaMelech asked this question, and the Ribbono Shel Olam answers him back. Amar Le HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God answers him back. Gzeira Hi Melefanai, this is the way the world runs. She'ein Modiin Kitzo Shel Basar Adam. We don't share that information. We don't disclose that information, and that for some reason is a secret that is withheld. And sometimes people will die very suddenly, very unexpectedly, and sometimes they might know when they're going to pass away, but he said, this is something that I absolutely cannot share with you. That's the way the world runs. That's what the Gemara says. I spoke yesterday. We have a monthly shiur in Citibank. It's a great, beautiful venue where we have a number of people who come together, and we have a shiur with a lunch, kosher lunch, and a kosher shiur, and a minyan for mincha after the shiur is completed. And it's a beautiful thing. It was spearheaded by people in the shul here. We have a very big crowd that comes. So yesterday, unfortunately, I had the opportunity to give the shiur. It was Rosh Chodesh. But unfortunately, it was in commemoration of a shloshim of Meir Weiss. I don't know if anyone knows about Meir Weiss, but he was a 28-year-old young man who had a sudden aneurysm out of nowhere, and he passed away without having any previous or prior medical history at all. So his father works in Citibank and comes to all of our shiurim, so he asked me that yesterday was the shloshim, that we have a shiur in his memory and talk a little bit about that. And I was thinking to myself, as I was preparing this shiur, that David HaMelech asked, Hodieni Hashem Kitzi. A person would like to know when that is going to come and how much they should fight and when, what to expect in life. And unfortunately, that's a secret that sometimes has a tragic end. Sometimes you have a 28-year-old who can pass away out of nowhere with no advance warning, and they did not have a chance to properly plan for that and what's going to be and how they should lead life, knowing that that's what's going to come. That's what David HaMelech asked, and unfortunately David HaMelech's question, his request, was not granted to him. However, God gives him a little bit. And what does God give him? He says, at least I'll tell you what day of the week you're going to die. So David HaMelech is told, and he is reassured, that he's going to die on a Shabbos. So you ever notice that on Matzah Shabbos, for those who are careful to eat Malav HaMalka, we have an obligation to eat Malav HaMalka. For those who are careful to eat Malav HaMalka, you're wonderful. For those who are really super careful and you not only eat Malav HaMalka, but you also say all the Zmiris in the Bencher for Malav HaMalka, which I personally don't do. But for those who are careful to say, you'll notice that we call the Malav HaMalka meal the Sudas David Malka Mashicha. Why do we call it the Suda of David HaMelech? Where does that come from? What does Malav HaMalka have to do with David HaMelech? Ever think about that? So the answer is that David HaMelech, the Gemara says, was so excited every time he made it successfully through another Shabbos, he made a party right after Shabbos was over to celebrate the fact that now he's given another week of life. So we're told that because David HaMelech was promised he's going to be, his life is going to be taken on a Shabbos, he was sitting, he was petrified every Shabbos when he came into it. He thought, maybe this is the week. Once Shabbos was over, he realized, I made it through another week, and now God gave me another week of life. Maybe it will be next week. And he makes a big party, and that's why Malava Malka is called the Sudas David Malka Mashiach, because David HaMelech is the one who made that party on Matzai Shabbos, and that's the same thing that we do. So, we know that David HaMelech is told he's going to die on a Shabbos. He just doesn't know which Shabbos. Now, David HaMelech decides he has a great idea. God wants to take my life on a Shabbos, but God can't take my life while I'm in the middle of doing something very important. So he makes sure that he's never going to have a moment free on Shabbos in which God can catch him and send the Malach HaMavis to take his life away. This is not a Bava Maisa. The Gemara says the story. So David HaMelech decides that he's going to sit and learn without rest at all over Shabbos, and he's going to spend every moment of Shabbos learning and studying Torah, and this way, if the Malach HaMavis is sent down to take his life away, the Malach HaMavis won't be able to stop him from doing what he's doing, and he can't lose his life. So, one fine day, God decides, now is your time. Sends down the Malach HaMavis to get David HaMelech. David HaMelech is learning. He can't get him. Tries to distract him, tries to do this, tries to do that. Could not get David HaMelech to go away from his attention that he had in his learning, until finally he makes something, the Gemara says, the trees rustled or the trees fell down, something of that nature, and David HaMelech turned around to see what happened, and at that moment he lost his life. That's the background of the story. What does that have to do with us? What it has to do with us is the following. Shlomo HaMelech, who is the son, realizes that his father just passed away outside in the garden. His father was learning peacefully out in the garden. Boiling hot sun, and he says, my father's dead body is laying outside in that burning hot sun, and it happens to be Shabbos, we're not allowed to bury him. He runs into the local base medrash and he says, what do I do? My father's body is muktzah. My father's body is muktzah. He just passed away. He's sitting outside in the burning hot sun. It's going to decompose. It's going to rot if we leave it out there. All the animals are going to come and make the body in a do something to the body that shouldn't be done. Bizayon hames. How can I leave my father out there in the burning hot sun and leave him to the animals, but at the same time, how can I carry his body inside when after all I know that your body, the body of the person who has passed away, is muktzah? Well, that would seem to be an indication that the laws of muktzah already were around in the times of David HaMelech. And that's why Shlomo doesn't know what to do. His father passes away on the Shabbos, and he's stuck with the problem. How can I leave my father's body outside? He's going to decompose. But how can I take it inside if we know that that's something that would be a violation of muktzah? So that was the dilemma Shlomo HaMelech is faced with. And he goes to discuss it with the others in his generation who doesn't know what to do. Now, how many years before Nehemiah did Shlomo HaMelech live? So let's do the math. David HaMelech lived in the time of which Beis HaMikdash? None. He built it, right? So he built the first Beis HaMikdash. Him and Shlomo HaMelech were the first ones. Nehemiah is the one who came after Galus Bavel. So you had the Beis HaMikdash. First Beis HaMikdash lasted how long? What? A couple of hundred years. Then you had a 70-year break in between. Everybody left Eretz Yisrael. Either they were kicked out or they left on their own. They went down to Bavel. Then Ezra tries to encourage everybody to come back. 70 years later, it's time to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Let's go back. God will allow us to do that. Then he comes back. So this is at least 500 years later that Nehemiah is the one who is instituting muktzah. Well, how can that be? Nehemiah institutes muktzah because he sees that the generation is lax. Don't we know that David HaMelech already was faced with this problem when he passed away? Seems to be a very obvious question. If you put the two stories in the Gemara together, it doesn't really make sense. Who is the one who came up with this idea of muktzah? So the Netziv gives an answer. The Netziv was one of the great gedolim in the early 1900s. The Netziv gives an approach which is, in general, a fascinating approach to think about. So the Netziv writes that the answer is, you're both right. How can you both be right? So he says, you have to understand there's a principle that we have in general when it comes to a rabbinic prohibition or any rabbinic decree. Anytime you have a takana midirabbanan, you have to think to yourself, did the rabbis just wake up one day and on the wrong side of the bed they decided, you know, oh, we're having a bad day, so let's take out our anger on everybody else and let's decide we're going to have muktzah today. Is that really how it happened? Was there any process that went along into that decree that they made? Of course there had to be. Of course they discussed it amongst themselves, but besides for discussing it amongst themselves, the Netziv writes, there has to be, it's almost a democratic process in order for something like that to get started. What do we mean? So he points us to a Gemara Meseches Avodah Zarah Daf Lamed Vav, where the Gemara says, a principle, Ein gozrin gzeira al hatzibur elim kein rov hatzibur yicholim lamod ba. So that was a lot in one statement, but what it means is, they don't have a right to make any kind of prohibition, to institute anything, unless they think that their generation can actually handle it, can abide by it. If you're going to have rabbis that are living in an ivory tower and don't understand the needs of the community and don't understand where the community is holding, they cannot make institutions because no one's going to listen to them. And that is not going to be a binding institution. We're not going to be punished for not listening to them if they instituted something that is just outside of our reach, if it's something that we just cannot handle. That's what the Gemara says. So for example, the Gemara there happens to be discussing, there was a time when the rabbis were concerned that much of the land of Eretz Yisrael was being eaten up by the animals. And it didn't look nice because the cities, if you have all the grass, is being ripped out of the ground by the little animals that are running around, all the sheep and the goats, so that's going to be a problem. So the Gemara says they made a rabbinic decree, no one's allowed to raise sheep or goats in the land of Israel. This way we're going to have a very nice country. That's what the Gemara says at a certain point in history. Why didn't they also say you're not allowed to have cows and donkeys and horses and everything else? Well, why were they only concerned about the sheep and the goats? So the Gemara says, because if they would have made a decree that you're not allowed to have any animals in Israel, that's something that the Jewish community couldn't handle. What do you mean? We need to have animals. We need to have produce. We need to have livestock. This is part of the business. This is part of the industry. We cannot just get up and say, you're never allowed to have any animals in Eretz Israel because we're concerned that it's going to ruin the land. So here the Gemara says, clearly that's an example of something where the rabbis would have wanted to institute all the way, but they were concerned if we do that, it's something the community is just not up to handling, not up to accepting. And therefore, the Gemara tells us they made sure to limit their decree because otherwise it just wouldn't have taken hold at all. And the Rambam goes so far as to say, what if the Chachamim didn't evaluate properly? They make a decree and it happened to be they were mistaken. They thought everybody can handle it and it turns out they were awfully wrong and nobody's able to handle the decree. So they wait around 2-3 years to see, does it pick up? Does it work? And the Rambam says, if it doesn't, because people simply are not up to the level of accepting what it is that they've been told to do. So the Rambam says it will just be repealed automatically. It will just fall by the wayside and everyone can just forget about it by itself. This does not mean that if now we live in a generation where the laws of Muktzah have already been in place for a few thousand years, it doesn't mean, oh, I think Muktzah is difficult, so therefore let's get rid of it. That's not what it means. It means when a decree is originally instituted, part of the decision-making process has to be, is our generation either worthy of this or ready and able to accept it. If not, it's something we don't have the right as the rabbinic authorities of the generation to institute. So that's what the Gemara says clearly. And I think it's just a general comment to be aware of, that any time a shaila is presented, one needs to make sure that it's presented to a personality who understands the circumstances of the life that you live. And I think it's something that we often make a mistake about. It doesn't mean that we don't respect leaders of other communities, but it does mean that we should not be asking our shilas to leaders of other communities because they don't understand the circumstances in which we live. And very often, that's a very important part, that's a critical component to any shila that's being asked. If we ask a shila whether or not we should have this kind of internet or that, and we're asking a shila of a person who doesn't even have a computer in their house, who doesn't understand the need for a computer in our society, in our generation, in our community, they're not going to give the answer that's commensurate to the question that you're asking because they don't understand how critical it is for you to have that. It's just one very simple example, but I think in general we need to ask ourselves, whenever such a question is posed, we need to ask ourselves, are we really presenting our questions to people who understand where the question is coming from? And that's a very critical point that always needs to be figured out before a question is able to be answered in all areas of life and halacha. Otherwise, you're going to get an answer that really doesn't fit with the life that you're living and therefore, it means it's not really the right answer. So, it doesn't always mean everything's mutter, it doesn't mean everything's usser. It just means you have to take that into consideration when the question is being asked and when it's being formulated. And that's exactly what the Rambam says here. If the Chachamim made a decree, but they were not in touch with the generation at the time to have an understanding or an appreciation of what the generation can handle, then it's out the window. Because they cannot just make decrees and throw them out at the people and assume everyone's going to accept that. We need to have Rabbanim, we need to have leaders who are understanding of where the generation is holding and what people can handle and what perhaps they cannot. And therefore, says the Netziv, that's really what happened with the laws of Muktzah. David HaMelech lives at a time where he sees there's a very lackadaisical attitude toward the laws of Shabbos, and he sees we have to do something in order to encourage people to be more enthused about keeping Shabbos properly and about being more careful. So he decides, you know what, laws of Muktzah, that's the answer. Great idea. The problem is, David HaMelech, you're not in touch with your community. You're not in touch with your generation. You don't understand that they're not in a place where they can handle that. And therefore, David HaMelech tried it. He happened to be the one who suffered as a result of it because his body passed away on Shabbos, outside in the sun, and he was going to decompose, and now they're faced with the Shiloh. What do we do? But it just so happens to be, because it didn't pick up, it didn't take root, it was gotten rid of, it was repealed. Many generations later, about 500 years later, Nehemiah comes around and he says, look, now I think we've grown, I think we've come to a level where we would be able to handle this. We do need to strengthen Shabbos. Why don't we take that great idea of David HaMelech's time and reinstitute it today? So that, says the Netziv, is how the history evolved, that's really how everything happened, and that's really where the laws of Muktzah came from, either from Nehemiah or from the story by David HaMelech. But either way, it seems from the Gemara that it was only a rabbinic decree, which leads us to a major problem, because we have a Gemara Maseches Pesachim, Daf Mem Zayin, where the Gemara tells us something that would seem to be contrary to what we've just spoken about. So the Gemara says the following story. We have sometimes a person who violates an Aveira in the Torah, they will be punished with Malkus, with lashes. So the Gemara says that you can only punish a person if they violate a biblical prohibition. You can only punish them with lashes if they violate something that's in the Torah. If they violate something that is only midrabanan, that was instituted by the rabbis, how can we give them a biblical punishment? That doesn't make sense. So the Gemara says, is there such a thing as a person violating one act, but in that one act that they violate, they're going to be punished many, many times for something that they did? Can you conceive of such a case, says the Gemara? The Gemara says, sure. What's such a case? Where you do one act, and in that one act, you're going to be punished many times because you violated many averes in one act. So Lashon Hara, you're going to be punished, but the question is there anything you can do? Again, the Chafetz Chaim writes that if a person speaks Lashon Hara, they violate 35 Yisurim, whatever it is. But we don't give a person Malkus for talking Lashon Hara, thank God. If we did, we would have big problems. Now, there are rules and regulations when a person gets Malkus. One rule is the only time a person can be punished with Malkus is if they do a Lav Sheyesh Bo Maisa. It's only the kind of prohibition that requires an activity, an action on our part, in order to violate. If it's something that just happens by speaking, that's not called a real activity. It doesn't mean that we don't take Lashon Hara seriously. Like the Chafetz Chaim teaches us, it's very serious, but it doesn't mean that you get lashes for everything. So the Gemara says, let's say you have something which does require my activity, it does require my involvement, so you're going to be punished with Malkus, but is there something that I can do that I'll be punished with five different sets of Malkus for doing one act? How can that be? So the Gemara says, listen to the following case. Hamevashel, somebody who cooks, Gid HaNasha, in milk, on Yom Tov. So let's count. How many problems have you just violated? How many things have you done wrong? Number one, you're cooking meat and milk together. Number two, it's Gid HaNasha, which is prohibited. Number three, says the Gemara, you're cooking on Yom Tov something that you weren't allowed to cook, so you're violating the prohibition of Bishul. You're not, by the way, secret. You're not allowed to cook anything you want on Yom Tov. Important principle to be aware of. Cooking on Yom Tov is not permissible. Cooking on Yom Tov is only permissible under certain circumstances, under certain conditions. That is something many people are not aware of. We're not just allowed to freely cook on Yom Tov whatever we want. There are rules and regulations of how and when we are allowed to use the method of cooking on Yom Tov. So here, where you had no right to cook on Yom Tov, so the Gemara says you're going to be punished for cooking on Yom Tov the Gid HaNasha in the milk, which you didn't have any right to cook. So the Gemara says, but how do you come up with five? How do you come up with a person who's going to do one act of cooking on Yom Tov where you're going to be punished five different times? So the Gemara tries to dream up of the scenario to figure out how we can do this. One way the Gemara explains it is, well, first of all, you're cooking milk and meat. Second of all, it's also Yom Tov. Third of all, it's Gid HaNasha. Fourth of all, says the Gemara, you took branches of a tree that fell off the tree on Yom Tov itself, which means they're absolutely muktzah. And those are the branches that you used in order to create your fire to cook this pot of stew, whatever it was. And therefore, says the Gemara, on top of what you're going to be punished for the cooking and the basar b'chalav and cooking on Yom Tov and everything else, you're going to be punished for the muktzah handling that you did of taking those branches that fell off the tree on Yom Tov that weren't available before, and now you're using them on Yom Tov, that's muktzah, therefore you're going to be punished. Isn't that a problem? How can I get malchus? How can I get punished for using branches that fell off a tree on Yom Tov because they're muktzah? Isn't that only a Isser midirabanan? Isn't that only a rabbinic prohibition? And if that's true, one cannot be deserving of malchus for that. So how does the Gemara use that in trying to configure how a person violated one activity and gets five punishments for that? How can this be one of the punishments? What have I done? On a biblical level, I did nothing wrong. Question clear? So what are we dealing with? And it's important whenever you deal with any halachic topic to figure out first whether we're dealing with something which is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan, as we'll see. It has tremendous consequences. So This is very important. How do we figure out what that Gemara is describing? How can we understand why that Gemara says that perhaps using the branches that fell off the tree on Shabbos that were unavailable before Shabbos is now considered to be a violation of Muktzah? How can you tell me that? Isn't that only Midrabbanan? And the Gemara here is talking about biblical prohibitions. So there are two basic approaches that are given. One approach that's given is the following. You're right. The normal cases of Muktzah that we talk about in our lexicon are, can I hold the hammer or the nail? Can I move my cell phone? All those different things. That's baby talk. That's little Muktzah. That's no big deal. That's Midrabbanan. That came later. We have a super duper Muktzah, which is something that the Torah already describes. What is that? That's what we call Nolad. Something that was actually created on Shabbos or Yom Tov itself, that is something that is so absolutely Muktzah that even the Torah said that's not permissible. So for example, the Gemara says here, you have a case of wood that falls off of a tree on Shabbos, which means when Shabbos came in, it was totally unusable because I wasn't allowed to break off a branch of a tree on Shabbos. So when Shabbos came in, on the onset of Shabbos, I was not able to use that. Now that in the middle of Shabbos it falls off the tree, that is what we call Muktzah Denola. That is the super Muktzah because that was so out of my league, I never would have thought to use such a thing. Says the Gemara, that already is something that is biblically prohibited. Okay, is that clear? So we have two different categories of Muktzah. One is the just regular Muktzah of handling different things in our house. The second category of Muktzah is something which is what we call Nolad. And someone asked a great question last night. What would be a very practical case of something which is created on Shabbos? So, most often we don't have the urge, the desire to take a branch that fell off a tree on Shabbos and use it for a very important purpose. But sometimes we do have a desire to take snow that falls on Shabbos and use that. So somebody asked last night a very good question. Maybe we should say that snow or rain that falls on Shabbos is considered to be Muktzah because that is the classical case of Nolad. That's something that was created seemingly on Shabbos. Now it's such a good question, the Gemara even asked that question. Should we assume that rain that falls on Shabbos is considered to be this real Muktzah because after all, it's something that seems to have been created on Shabbos itself. Before Shabbos was here, there was no rain, there was no snow. Now Shabbos came in, all of a sudden the snow, the rain starts to fall. Is that something that is prohibited on Shabbos? Should we say that snow is Muktzah? Now I'm not allowed to shovel it, and now I'm not allowed to move it, now I can't make a snowball, now I'm not allowed to do all kinds of things with the snow, or should you assume not? And the Gemara basically comes to the conclusion that we don't assume that rain is really considered to be Muktzah on Shabbos because the Gemara says we assume that there was moisture in the air beforehand, and all of it just collected and condensed, and now it came in to be rain. It's not that it was created on Shabbos itself, it was there all along. It just now changed forms a little bit, but now it has come down in a different form. One very practical example that comes up in Eretz Yisrael a lot is, sometimes in Eretz Yisrael they have window units of air conditioners. So, let's say you have a central air unit, it's not really going to happen, but if you have a window unit, and very often you'll see there in Eretz Yisrael, you have a little pipe going from the air conditioner outside, so it's dripping outside of the apartment building, outside of the house. So that water that comes out of the air conditioner, everybody agrees, that is real Nolad. That was actually created on Shabbos. Why? Because it's not like there was moisture in the air and now the moisture turned into something else. No, that's not like rain. That's something that because the air conditioner is running, now the water was actually created on Shabbos. It's something that was not there and would not have been there if not for the fact that the air conditioner was running. That's a practical case of something which is really Nolad. I would never want to drink such water or use it for anything. But conceivably, if you had such a case, that would be something that is really considered to be Nolad. So that's approach number one. We had a discrepancy whether we should assume that Muktzah on Shabbos is considered an Isser D'Oraisa. Is it biblical or is it only rabbinic? The answer is yes. 99% of the times it's only a rabbinic prohibition. 1% of the time when you have this unusual case of something that was actually created on a Shabbos itself, then we would assume that that is considered to be Muktzah on a level of D'Oraisa. That is approach number one. Approach number two is, the Chasam Sofer writes, maybe the difference is, we can draw a distinction between whether you're talking about tiltal Muktzah, whether you're talking about handling Muktzah and moving something from one side of the house to the other, or you're talking about actually consuming or eating Muktzah. And the Chasam Sofer says that would be a difference, because if you're actually going to destroy or consume or get rid of the item, that is something that might be biblical. If you're talking about just moving something around the house, that is only something that was added on later on. Either way, this is a major discussion that is spoken about by the great Gedolim of many generations ago. How do we look at Muktzah and what is our perspective? Should we assume it's D'Oraisa? Should we assume it's D'Rabbanan? The accepted understanding, the conventional understanding, is that Muktzah is generally assumed to be only an Isser D'Rabbanan. And one will ask themselves, what difference does it make if we're talking about an Issur d'Rabbanan or we're talking about an Issur d'Oraisa? Either way, we assume you got to listen, either because the Torah told you to listen or because the Chacham told you to listen. So why should it make a difference? Why are we getting so caught up with this seemingly insignificant detail about whether or not this is biblically prohibited or rabbinically prohibited? And the answer to that is very simple. We have two overarching principles whenever we deal with any area of halacha, and that is, when you're dealing with something which is a mitzvah d'oraisa, something which is a biblical obligation, we assume safek d'oraisa l'chumra. So for example, a person is not sure, says the Gemara Maseches Brachos, I don't know this morning, I had a busy morning, I ran to the gym, I did whatever I did, I can't remember, did I say Kriya Shema or not? It can happen, I assume. You don't remember whether or not you said Kriya Shema, you don't remember whether or not you daven. So it's pathetic if by 10 o'clock you don't remember whether or not you daven, but sometimes it happens, unfortunately. It means we don't think enough about the davening that we do if by 10 o'clock we can't remember. However, once in a while it happens, so the Gemara says, what do you do? If you don't know whether or not you said Kriya Shema, you don't know whether or not you daven. So the Gemara says, if you're not sure whether or not you said Kriya Shema, since the nature of the obligation of Kriya Shema is a biblical obligation, you have an obligation to say it again. Because you have to err on the side of caution when we're talking about a mitzvah midaraisa. And therefore, since Kriya Shema is something that the Torah mandates us to say, you don't have a right to say, well, I'm not sure, and therefore, okay, forget about it, I'll catch up tomorrow. No, since it's daraisa, you have to say it once again if you're in doubt, if you really have a doubt and you're not sure. However, says the Gemara, what if a person is not sure whether or not they daven Shemona Esrei? So since Shemona Esrei is assumed to be something which is only midrabanan, therefore we assume when a person is in doubt and they're really unsure whether or not they daven, we can say, okay, it's only midrabanan, therefore you have a right to just rely on the fact that you probably did, and no reason to trouble yourself to daven again. That's what the Gemara says. A very practical application of this rule of Safik Daraisa L'chumra is as follows, and it's something people often don't realize, but it often comes up. So take, for example, the Gemara says in Maseches Nida, Daf Mem Vav, the Gemara tells us, how do we know when a man or a woman is of the age to be considered to be a bar or bas mitzvah? So the Gemara says the body has to have certain changes that take place in order for us to know that the child is really considered to be an adult. So what do? We go and we check every young man and every young lady to really find out and know with certainty that their body is already an adult body? Of course we don't do that. So the Gemara says, then how are we supposed to know whether or not somebody is an adult? So the Gemara says, look, we have an assumption, it's a chazaka, we have the right to assume that by the time a girl reaches the age of 12 years old and a man reaches the age of 13, you have the right to assume that they probably are already considered to be an adult and the body has already gone through some of the changes that are necessary in order to be considered as such. That's what the Gemara says. So what does that mean, we have a right to assume? You have a right to assume with 99% certainty? You have a right to assume with 60% certainty? Like, how sure are we of this assumption? Sometimes you have kids who are 12, 13 years old, and they look like babies. And maybe their bodies are not developing yet. So what does that mean, we have a right to assume? Does the Gemara mean to say, no, you have a right to assume because this is what happens every time? Or does it mean you have a right to assume because most of the times this is what happens? What's the difference? So the difference would be as follows. In many homes where you have a married couple, so I think in most homes the practice is, on Friday night when it's time to say Kiddush, the husband of the house will say the Kiddush. So what happens? The husband is now on a business trip for Shabbos, he's not available, and we're all excited that our bar mitzvah boy who just became bar mitzvah is going to be home to say the Kiddush for us, it's great, but he just turned 13 years old. Is he the one who can say Kiddush on behalf of the whole family? No. Why not? Because all of us are obligated to recite Kiddush biblically. Midaraisa, we have a mitzvah to recite Kiddush. This child, we don't know with certainty, is yet considered to be a gadol. We don't know. We're just assuming, just because he turned 13, we're assuming that he's already a bar mitzvah. But we don't really know that with certainty. Nobody ever checked. If he has facial hair growing on his face, so then we know, obviously, he's already considered to be of the age. But most of the times, that's not the case. So how do you know with certainty? You don't know with certainty. And because we don't know with absolute certainty that this child is already considered to be of the age of bar mitzvah, where he's a gadol, he might not be obligated in the mitzvah of Kiddush on Friday night. Therefore, he cannot fulfill the obligation on behalf of all of us either. So the Mishnah Brewer comes to the conclusion, whenever we're dealing with a mitzvah midaraisa, you have to err on the side of caution and say, we're not really sure about this child, and therefore the child cannot be the one to recite the Kiddush on behalf of everybody else because maybe the child is not obligated. It's something people don't realize, but it's something to keep in mind. Take for another example. Rosh Hashanah comes around, we have an obligation to blow the shofar in the shul. Now the Torah says we have to blow the shofar in the shul. And we have a kid who for the last 6 months has been practicing, he wants to be the Baal Tokeah, he wants to be the one to blow the shofar. Comes Rosh Hashanah, he just became a bar mitzvah, he wants to be the one to be designated as the one to blow the shofar for the whole community. Answer is, he cannot be the one. Why? Because we have a biblical obligation to blow the shofar. We don't know that you're yet biblically obligated to do this mitzvah. Until we know with certainty that you are obligated to do the mitzvah, we cannot rely on the fact that maybe you are obligated, and that's why we have this principle of suffik daraisa luchumra, which would govern in a very common case. Let's say the kiddush or the shofar or anything of that nature. When you have a mitzvah daraisa, you have to err on the side of caution. Yes, a question.
Yeah, how about fine minyan?
Right. Right. So we assume that minyan is a mitzvah which is only midirabbanon. So because it's only midirabbanon, you have a right to assume, okay, he's probably a bar mitzvah because most of the times a kid who's 13 is already considered to be an adult, and that would suffice, that would be good enough. Here's where we draw the distinction between a mitzvah midaraisa and a mitzvah midirabbanon. We have a second principle, which is safek dirabbanon lekula. For example, the Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Reish Tess, what happens if a person, and it happens all the time, person is not sure. I went to the ladies' room. I don't know. Did I say Asher Yatzah? Did I not? I assume it happens all the time. You get distracted. Your cell phone rings. Something happens. You washed your hands. Somebody stopped you. Somebody's pulling your leg. Literally, a child is tugging at you, right? So things can happen that you can get distracted and you forget, did I make this bracha? Did I not? Shulchan Aruch says clearly, since we're dealing with a bracha, and a bracha is only a mitzvah midrabbanan, therefore, if you're not sure, if you're legitimately not sure, we say, don't recite the bracha again. It's only a mitzvah midirabbanan. You have the right to say, I can rely on the fact that maybe I did it, maybe I didn't. That's good enough. Another example. We have a prohibition on Shabbos of taking medicine. Unless one is considered to be some level of a chola. You can't just say anybody who feels anything is allowed to take medication on Shabbos. The Gemara says there's a prohibition to take medicine on Shabbos. Unless you're in a situation where you are a chola. Is this something people never heard? Okay, this is, let's back up. The Gemara says we have a prohibition to take medications on Shabbos. Why is that? Because we're concerned maybe someone's going to crush up the ingredients, and crushing up the ingredients is considered to be a malacha midaraisa. So the Gemara says one is not allowed to take medications. However, if you're in a certain situation where you are ill, and you're a certain level of sickness, or you're not going to be able to function properly, for example, a woman is on a birth control pill, and you're going to tell her, well, over Shabbos, okay, so you won't take it. She's not going to function normally over that Shabbos. She's not going to be able to live normally over the course of the 24 hours knowing that she can't take the pill. Or you have somebody who needs to take caffeine pills. They need to take it every day because otherwise their stomach is going to be giving them an issue, is going to be problematic. So anything like that which makes you not be able to function normally, you have heart medication. Obviously, if you don't take it for a day, we don't tell the person, don't take that. Obviously, you're allowed to take that. But anything else, you have to really determine whether or not the person is of a level of sickness where you're allowed to take a medication. Well, says of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, what if a person on Shabbos is just not feeling well, but they don't know, am I really not feeling well enough that I'm allowed to take the Tylenol, the Advil, or is this something, all right, you suffer through it, you make it through Shabbos, and you're really not sure. You're not sure, am I at that level or not? Says of Shlomo Zalman, because we're dealing with something which is only an Isser through Rabbanon, a rabbinic prohibition, you're allowed to take the medicine in such a case. Doesn't mean you're allowed to be ignorant and not look into it about what the laws are and what they aren't. That's not what safek d'rabbanan lekula means. It doesn't mean, oh, if I don't know, so therefore I'm allowed to do anything. It means if you actually do know the halacha, you just happen to be unsure about this very specific application of the halacha, so then we say, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, so you take the medication, because after all, at worst, we're dealing with only an issur d'rabbanan, and therefore he says you have a right to be mekel. A very prevalent example, Avadi Yosef discusses it at length, and many others of his contemporary generation discuss it as well. You have every so often, you go to a funeral, and you go to the Beis HaKvaros, and it's already, the grave diggers are taking their time, or whatever it is, till the family shows up, and then we start doing the Kvura, and then we realize it's almost the Shkia. So you'll notice that everybody starts rushing to try to do it as quickly as possible. Why? Why are we in such a rush? Because who wants to sit an extra day of Shiva? Nobody wants to sit an extra day of Shiva, so we try as best as we can to finish it before the Shkia. This way the family can go on the side, start the Shiva on the side of the road by the cemetery, and then you knock off one day of Shiva already there just by sitting for 5 minutes. That's the general practice that we have. What happens if you cannot control it? What happens if things get delayed, and now we miss the Shkia by 5 minutes, And now it's already considered to be somewhat of nightfall. So what happens after it's shkia at night? After the sun sets at night, we have this period called Bein HaShemashos, which means we're not really sure. Is this considered to be day? Is this considered to be night? It's very unclear. So Rav Avadia Yosef argues, if you have a situation like that, and the family just finished burying their relative, and they don't want to sit another day of Shiva. So he says, since Avelus and Shiva is only Midrabanan in the first place, let them sit down for 5 minutes on the side of the road now, even though it's already after the Shkia, even though it's already the period of Bein HaShemashos, and he says that will be able to count for one day already. Since we're dealing with something which is only Midrabanan anyway, he says, Safek Dirabanan Lekula, and therefore we have a right to assume, because this is the twilight zone where we're unsure whether it's still day or it's already considered to be night, so therefore he says, we can say, since we're dealing with an Issur Dirabanan, you have the right to say, good enough. You already counted as one day of Shiva, now you can go home and move on, and tonight's sitting will be considered as the second day of Shiva already. We have many applications, we don't have to say any more, but there are many, many applications of this principle of Safek Dirabanan Lekula. Now make no mistake, the Rambam warns us, don't think that just because we say Safek Dirabanan Lekula, that when a person is in doubt, they don't have to be machmir, that doesn't mean that Dinam Dirabanan are insignificant, are unimportant, are inconsequential. We don't assume that. We assume they are very important. In fact, the Rambam goes on to a whole discussion about how important it is to keep the mitzvahs Dirabanan. It's something that's very important, but we just have different rules that govern mitzvahs d'oraisa and different rules that govern a mitzvah midrabanan. So when we have a mitzvah d'oraisa, as we mentioned, the rules that govern that are safek d'oraisa l'chumra. When a person is in doubt, they need to err on the side of caution. The rules that govern a mitzvah midrabanan are, when in doubt, you have a right to rely and say, I probably did it because I'm not sure. So that's the rule. Translate all of that into the laws of muktzah. For those who remember, we're in the middle of a discussion about muktzah. So we discussed that it was a discussion in the Gemara whether Nehemiah is the one who instituted muktzah or David HaMelech instituted muktzah. And we came to the conclusion that whoever it was, we assume that muktzah is considered to be only a rabbinic prohibition, an Isser D'Rabbanan. Well, if that's the case, I would have naturally said that when a person is in doubt about muktzah on Shabbos, I should have the right to be lenient. I should have the right to say Safek D'Rabbanan Lekula. Should I not? That's the governing principle by every other mitzvah d'rabbanan or issur d'rabbanan, so why shouldn't this be the same? But the problem is, the Gemara says not so. So the Gemara gives us a case and says, when you have a suffix, when a person is in doubt about something with regard to the laws of muktzah, you have to be machmir. Why is that? That would seem to be contrary to everything we are building up to. It doesn't seem to be correct. So the Gemara gives us the following case. You have, on Shabbos, you have a backyard that has a beautiful garden, and not only do you have flowers there, but you also have fruit trees. So you have an apple tree. You happen to love apples. You see there's an apple on the floor Shabbos afternoon. You're not sure, did that apple fall off the tree before Shabbos began? Or did the apple fall off the tree after Shabbos began? The difference is that going to be muktzah? If the apple fell off the tree before Shabbos started, you're allowed to eat it. If the apple fell off the tree after Shabbos started, it's considered to be muktzah because at the time of the onset of Shabbos, it was connected to the tree, which didn't allow you to eat it. So that would be an application, says the Gemara. What if a person sees that apple outside and they really have no way of determining whether or not the apple fell today or the apple fell before Shabbos? So the Gemara says you have to be machmir. The Gemara says you have to say one is not allowed to use that apple at all because we're assuming that perhaps it fell on Shabbos. Maybe it's muktzah, and therefore you have to be machmir. Yeah. What? Now what? Marasayin is a very fluid term because it's very difficult to really determine. Let's say, you know, we have many things that might be a marasayin that might not be. It really depends on the time and place, what people are going to assume. I would imagine most people who see you walking around on Shabbos with an apple, even if you have an apple tree, are assuming that you probably did not pick it off the tree. Right? I would assume. What? In any day and age, I would imagine. I don't know. Marasayin is a very complicated question, and a further question of marasayin is, do I have a right to institute new marasayin? Let's say there's something that I'm concerned about. Right? So does that mean we have, in every generation, we have to come up with new marasayins, new applications of the halacha, or do we say whatever it was? That's a very difficult question, but I'm not sure we would extend it to here by eating an apple on Shabbos.
The more basic question is, there's the concept of, well, it's
So that's a question in general. What right do the Chachamim ever have to institute something new? Don't we have a prohibition of Baal Tosav, of adding onto the laws of the Torah? The understanding that the Rishonim give is, we assume that Baal Tosav means you're not allowed to add onto a law of the Torah itself. So let's say the Torah says to shake four items on Sukkis. So you're going to decide, oh, we're going to put a rose in there also because we think the rose is going to make it look nicer. Maybe that's Baal Tosav, because you're adding on to what the Torah said, exactly how the Torah prescribed the mitzvah to be performed. But over here, where the Chachamim, first of all, have a power vested in them that they have the ability to make a siyag, to make a hachaka, when they see that there's a lacking in some area, they have a right to add something on, it has to be done with the proper rules. Everything has rules and regulations. Just like math and science have rules and regulations, the Torah and rabbinic laws also have rules and regulations of where it's appropriate and where perhaps it's not. So muktzah is something that was instituted, and the question is, what are the rules of muktzah? That's what we're here to discuss in the next few weeks. But for our purposes now, what do you do when you have a suffik muktzah? You have this apple outside, you're not sure, am I allowed to eat the apple, am I not? So the Gemara says you have to be machmir. Why do I have to be machmir? We're dealing with an issur d'rabbanan here. Why do I have to be machmir? Shabbos. So what is Shabbos? But as far as the Torah is concerned, this has nothing to do with Shabbos. When the Torah told us to keep Shabbos, it didn't have this in mind. This was something that was added later on. So there are two basic approaches as to why it is that we have to go so far in the other direction when it comes to the laws of muktzah, which seems to be against all the regular rules that we generally follow. Generally we say, Safek Darabon Lekula, so why is it different here? Two basic approaches. One approach that's given is, well, you're right. In a general terms, we would assume that Safek Darabanan Lekula. You're not sure whether or not you daven, you're not sure whether or not you made a bracha, so forget about it. Don't beat yourself up over it, just move on with the day. However, here, since we're dealing with the laws of Shabbos, and people are so lax about the laws of Shabbos, and the Chachamim knew that, therefore they had to make a very special consideration here and say, anyone who violates the laws of Muktzah, or anyone who's not sure whether or not they are going to violate the laws of Muktzah, has to be machmer, because we don't want people playing games with Shabbos, which is similar to what you said. Shabbos is Shabbos. And because Shabbos is Shabbos, even when we're dealing with an issur d'rabbanan, we have to be machmer. That's one approach that's given. That's one approach that's given, that Shabbos is Shabbos. Second approach that's given is the following. The second approach that's given is the following. And in order to appreciate and understand its depth, think about this. Let's say you have a medication that you absolutely need to take. Doctors tell you you have some kind of condition, you need this kind of medication, this kind of pill, but the pill has non-kosher ingredients in it, which, by the way, happens all the time. We need to look into the pills and the vitamins that we take and find out, are they kosher or not? Let's say I absolutely need this pill. It's non-kosher. What would you tell me to do? Take the pill. Why? Because you're sick and you absolutely need it. It's only an issur d'rabbanan anyway. Everything's crushed up in there. There's no real treif in the pill. There's probably something which is only issur d'rabbanan. So we'll say, take the pill because you're a chola. You need to take the pill. What if you go to the supermarket and you have an option to take kosher pill or non-kosher pill? Do I have to go out of my way to buy the kosher pill or not? Yes, of course I have to. Why? Because why not? May I ask you, why do you have to take the kosher pill? Why don't you say, it's only Durabanan anyway and I happen to be sick, so I may as well take that. So the Netziv writes a comment where he says, in a case like that, in our terms, in a case like that, he says, this is the terminology that the Gemara uses for something similar. Ad she tochlenu be'isser, tochlenu be'heter. If you would be able to eat it in a permissible way, why would you look for the loophole to eat it in the non-permissible way? Again, if it's a difference of $100, a can of pills, whatever that's called, a pill box. So if it's a major discrepancy, so that's a different story. But if it's just $5, $10, we waste $5, $10 on many other things. So why would you go and look for the loophole to allow yourself to eat the non-kosher pill if you very easily have the option of eating the pill, which is kosher? That's what he says. And that's what many write over here as well. You're asking a question whether or not you have a right to eat this apple that fell off the tree. Because you don't know whether or not it fell on Shabbos or before Shabbos. Eat the apple tomorrow morning for breakfast. Why do you need to look for a loophole? It's not like you're starving today. It's not like you have nothing to eat. You have plenty of things to eat. So eat the apple tomorrow morning. And therefore, that's why many assume when it comes to a suffig muktzah and you're not sure whether or not the apple is allowed to be consumed, just wait till tomorrow to eat it. Wait till tomorrow to take it inside. Don't go out of your way to violate a law of muktzah when it's absolutely unnecessary. What would be a difference between those two answers? Is everybody following me? I hope. So a difference between those two answers would be the following. Let's say you're in a situation where you have an apple tree, and the apple has fallen off the tree, and you see it on the ground. You would love to go ahead and eat it. You would love to take it inside the house so it doesn't get rotten. However, you see that you have a bunch of dogs running around the backyard, or you have, it's a boiling hot day, and if you leave the apple outside on the floor, it's going to get rotten. It's not going to be available after Shabbos. It's not going to be available for my Sunday morning breakfast of champions. So what do I do? What would you say in a case like that? I have this apple that we're not sure if it fell off the tree on Shabbos or before Shabbos. You're not sure whether or not it's muktzah. You would leave it? Why would you leave it? But it's going to get rotten. It's going to get spoiled. It's not going to be there.
All right, but sometimes it just gets rotten.
So the... Both. So the answer is, it depends. It depends. Why are we... Listen carefully. Why are we machmir generally when you have a suffix with regard to the laws of muktzah? If you're machmir because Shabbos is Shabbos and you have to be careful about Shabbos, so here, Shabbos is Shabbos, so... Lose the apple, too bad. Rotten apples, that's what you're going to have. Let the animals get the apples, too bad you're going to lose it. If the reason why we're machmir by the laws of muktzah is because, what do you need it for? You'll get it tomorrow morning. What do you need to go out of your way now to be mechal Shabbos? Well, in this case, that doesn't apply, because in this case, it's not going to be here tomorrow morning. And since it's not going to be here tomorrow morning, we would assume, we don't just tell the person, why get involved in the issue now on Shabbos if you could just do it after Shabbos? No, I can't do it after Shabbos because it's not going to be available to me after Shabbos and I won't be able to make use of it after Shabbos. And therefore, in a case like that, maybe there would be room to be lenient. So now put on your seatbelts. Just listen to the following. It's a little bit complicated, but I think it's enriching. When you understand it and you really internalize it, it's very enriching. Listen to the following. So we just said a principle. Whenever we have an issa d'rabbanan, so you say, generally, safek d'rabbanan l'kula. Unless it's something that you can so easily avoid, so then we say, why rely on the safek d'rabbanan? Why rely on the kula? You may as well just do it the right way. Correct? Is that really true in this case? Take, for example. I assume many of us in the room, how many people wait 6 hours between fleishigs and milk? So most people. Some people wait 3, some people wait different things. Let's say 6 hours. So a very common question that we get is, I had a Shabbos meal with a whole load of company in the house, and now we were schmoozing for so long, we have no idea when did we finish eating fleishigs on the long Shabbosos, and we have no idea when are we milchigs. Correct? I assume this happens all the time. So number one, you're not fleishigs until the benching. You're fleishigs when you stopped eating meat. That's number one. So very often you can have dessert that takes an hour and a half with all the schmoozing and whatever until you finish benching. That doesn't count in the equation. So it comes to 7 o'clock on Shabbos afternoon, and you have no idea. What time did we finish? Was it 1 o'clock? Was it 2 o'clock? You don't remember. When did we clear the table? When did we bring all the meat off the table? Sometimes it's very hard for us to remember, and we don't know exactly. So we have a legitimate suffix at 7 o'clock. Are we able to have ice cream for Shalashudas or not? So what would you say? Are we talking about an Issa D'Oraisa or an Issa D'Rabbanan? All those in favor of D'Oraisa, raise your hands. Good. Wrong. It's an Issa D'Rabbanan. Because the only biblical prohibition is to eat meat and milk together that was cooked together. That's the real prohibition. You're not allowed to eat meat and milk that was cooked together. We made an extension of that and we said, not only are you not allowed to eat milk and meat that were cooked together, you're not even allowed to eat milk and meat that weren't cooked together at the same time. That's rabbinic number one. Rabbinic number two, now we extend it even further and we say you're not even allowed to eat milk and meat not at the same time. If you ate meat and you think that it was the kind of meat that got stuck in your teeth or maybe stuck in your mouth, stuck in your throat, whatever it might be, you have to wait 6 hours, says the Gemara, or 3 hours, whatever your practice is. You have to wait a long period of time, but that's only in Issa D'Rabbanan. So here I am, Shabbos afternoon, I really want to have ice cream for Shalashudas. It will enhance my Shabbos tremendously. And I would love to have that. Problem is, I don't really know, am I milchigs or not? We're dealing with, at worst, an Issa D'Rabbanan. So you should say, Safek D'Rabbanan L'Kula. I have a right to eat the ice cream. On the other hand, you'll say, come on. So you'll do without the ice cream, right? You'll eat the ice cream after Shabbos. No? So I would have said, Ad she'tochlenu be'iser, tochlenu be'eter. Why are you getting involved in the question? Just wait till after Shabbos to eat the ice cream. However, the Ne'odah Yehuda writes, how can you tell me, wait till after Shabbos to eat the ice cream? That's not the same as the case we were just talking about. When I have one apple, and I can either eat the apple now, or I can eat the apple tomorrow. So we say, eat the apple tomorrow. What's the big deal? What do you lose? When I have ice cream and I can eat ice cream now and later, correct? That's a different question. So don't tell me, don't eat the ice cream now because what's the big deal? You'll eat it after Shabbos and there will be no Shiloh. What do you mean? But after Shabbos is a different question. I want the pizza after Shabbos. I want the ice cream now. Am I making sense? So that's not the same. And therefore, the Noda Behuda argues, we wouldn't say, oh, you don't have a right to say Safed Yerabana Lekula because you can easily eat the ice cream after Shabbos. No. I want to have ice cream now. That will enhance my Shabbos now. I want to have pizza on Matzah Shabbos from Alava Malka. Those are two different questions. And therefore, we don't apply the principle of Ad Shetochlena Be'Isser Tochlena Be'Heter. It's not true. It's not true. Because that's something that is not going to be available after Shabbos. After Shabbos, it doesn't help me that for Shalosh Shudas, I couldn't eat anything. It doesn't mean we're going to starve. It means even if I do have food, but I really feel that I want the ice cream, there are many who assume that it would be permissible in that case because we assume that ice cream is what I want now. And it doesn't help me that tonight I'm going to have pizza. Right now I want the ice cream. Tonight I want something else. Take for another example. Sometimes you have a shayla in Ilchas Nida Midrabanan. Once in a while you have a case. You're not sure. Maybe there was a chatzitza Midrabanan in the mikvah. Whatever happens. Some kind of situation. It comes up every so often. So the Noda Behuda discusses that as well. What are you going to tell the couple? Big deal, you go tomorrow night again. Why get involved? Why say Safi Darabana Lekula? Oh, it probably was good, probably wasn't good, we don't know. Just go again tomorrow night and then you'll take care of the problem. What do you mean? But how does that help me now? The couple wants to be together tonight and tomorrow. And now you're going to tell them, oh, go tomorrow night. Why get involved in the Shaila? What do you mean, why get involved in the Shaila? My going tomorrow night doesn't help me tonight. Is that clear? So even when we're dealing with a Safik Durabanan, and there's in some way an easy way to get around the problem by just waiting till tomorrow, not always do we tell the person to wait till tomorrow. Not always do we tell the person, wait till after Shabbos to have the milchigs. Why? Because you want something right now. The husband and wife want to be together now. And just to tell them, wait another night, it's very nice to say that, but that doesn't help them. Because now they've just lost the whole day together. So these are some intricacies when it comes to the laws of Safek Derabanan Lekula, and how it applies here would be very important. So let's say you take, for example, our case of the apple. Person wants to get involved in something which is a Safek Muktzah. So if you only have one apple, so we tell you, okay, you only have one chance to eat to consume that item, so eat it tomorrow. What about when we're talking about a Safek Muktzah on Shabbos that can be moved around 100 different times on Shabbos itself? So I have a cell phone on the table, and I'm not sure am I allowed to move it or not. So you tell me, okay, move it after Shabbos. Doesn't help me to move it after Shabbos. Right now I need the table. I have a screwdriver on the table. I'm not sure. Am I allowed to move it? Is it halachically permissible to move that off the table or not? What are you going to tell me? Okay, why get involved in the Shiloh? Just wait till after Shabbos. What do you mean? That's not going to help me. Because I can move it now, I can move it later, or I can move it 100 times before Shabbos is over. And therefore, maybe we would say, Safek Derabanan Lekula would apply in such a circumstance. Again, just back up. The Gemara tells us that Safek Muktzah is going to be prohibited on Shabbos. The question that we asked was, why should Safek Muktzah be prohibited? And the answer that was suggested is, Safek Muktzah is not allowed is because, even though Muktzah is only Derabanan, since we're dealing with something that can easily be done after Shabbos is over, why get involved in the question? So when you have an option to eat the apple now, the one apple that fell off the tree, you can eat it today, you can eat it tomorrow, so eat it tomorrow, what's the big deal? What do you need to get involved? But when we're dealing with something that is going to be something that makes a difference to today, you're going to tell me, don't move the hammer off the table, don't move the cell phone off the table, because you may as well move it tomorrow when the Shiloh is not nogeh, when it's not relevant. What do you mean? But I'm having the company now. I want my table to be clean off now. So you can't tell me, wait till after Shabbos and then the Shiloh is over. The Shiloh is not relevant anymore. And in a case like that, we would say a Safek Muktzah under those kinds of circumstances would be permissible. So, I know there was a lot to swallow today. Let's just do a very quick review, and next week we will continue with more practical laws of Hilchos Muktzah. We began with the discrepancy that the Gemara has. Who is the one who instituted Muktzah? Was it Nehemiah or was it David HaMelech? Either way, the assumption pretty much is that Muktzah is assumed to be only a rabbinic prohibition. If we assume that Muktzah is a rabbinic prohibition, that should make a difference that every time you have a doubt about something being prohibited because of the laws of Muktzah, we should have said that everything is permissible. Why? Because Safek Derabanan Lekula, which is the guiding principle in all of Torah, in all of Halacha. And yet the Gemara tells us, no, Safek Muktzah is prohibited. Why should that be the case? Why should Safek Muktzah not be allowed on Shabbos? that seems to go against all the regular rules of Safek Dirabanan Lekula. And the answer to that is, number one, maybe because Shabbos is Shabbos. And when we're talking about Shabbos, we have to err on the side of caution for everything that we do. That's answer number one. Answer number two is no. Maybe the reason why the Gemara says that muktzah, when you're not sure about an item of muktzah, of the status of that item, why does the Gemara say you have to be machmir, you have to err on the side of caution? Because why get involved in the shayla? You may as well just wait till after Shabbos and then you can take care of it. However, we suggested there are many scenarios where that's not an option. There are many scenarios similar to the case of eating the milchigs after Shabbos is over that doesn't help me for the shalashunas ice cream that I want to eat. So in cases like that, we would still rely on the principle of Safek Dirabanan Lekula, even when it comes to the laws of muktzah, and therefore that would be permissible. So for example, we said, you have a situation where you have some item on the table that you don't want it to be there now, and you're not sure, do I have a right to move it or not? You can't tell me that, oh, don't move it because why get involved? You just move it after Shabbos. No, after Shabbos is over, it's not going to help me. I have the question now, am I allowed to move the muktzah? And the answer to that is, yes, you would be allowed to because we don't have that consideration about wait till after Shabbos and everything will take care of itself. So Amir Tashem next week.